Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Because as soon as you see something visible, like a white cane or hearing aids, people just immediately assume that you are incapable.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rui P, where we discuss the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. My guest today is quite simply one of the most amazing people I've ever had the privilege of meeting. And I've met quite a few in the process of doing this podcast by my privileged position of meeting patients who inspire me every single day. But Alexandra Adams is a very, very special person. She's a fourth year medical student at Cardiff University, and she is the UK's first deaf and blind person training to become a doctor. She's an ex-GB athlete in both swimming and alpine skiing. She's a published poet. She's a TED talker. She's just awe-inspiring. I'm speechless even now because I don't really know how to explain just how touching this podcast was to me. She's a lifelong patient of the NHS. She's been in hospital for 1.5 years as a teenager. She's had 17 admissions to an ICU since the start of medical school. She's also a victim. She's quite frankly shared her experiences of being discriminated against as a patient and as a medical student. And she's a huge advocate for better patient care through empathy. I really thought that this podcast was going to go a different route. And what it was for me was a huge roller coaster of emotions. I don't think I've laughed as much on a podcast. I don't think I've felt as angry. I certainly haven't felt this emotional. And I think it's going to be a journey for you guys. If I would request one thing, is that you listen to this, you give it your utmost attention, and you please check out Alexandra's incredible TED Talk, which you can find via her social media links. It's at Alexandra_DBMed. And she also has an incredible organization called Faces of the NHS, which hopes to remove the stereotypes in the NHS. And she's near to complete the writing of her first book as well. So she's almost an author to add to her many accolades. And you can find her organization at Faces of the NHS. I'm not going to talk anymore, too much more about this. The only thing I'm going to say is the recipe that I cooked Alexandra, which she loved, is on the YouTube channel, thedoctorskitchen.com. Please go check that out. She was the last podcast guest to be at the studio before we moved a location. And it was just a privilege to have her. It was also her birthday, so we gave her some cake at the end of the shoot, which is very fitting. Onto the podcast, and if you like this podcast, please do give it a 5-star review. It really does help. Alexandra, thank you so much for coming into the kitchen
today.
No worries,
I'm excited. I'm
excited. You are the final guest that we're going to be having here in the studio. So, and it's an absolute privilege to meet you and to get you here after connecting via social media. You are such a chatterbox.
which is such a good thing.
I'm going to lose my voice in a minute.
No, don't lose your voice. Don't lose your voice. Because sometimes, you know, we get guests to come in and, like, you know, it's a new environment and, like, there's lights everywhere and there's two people behind and we've got the audio producers. But you're, like, straight into it and I love it. Your personality is exactly how I imagine. So,
oh, thank you.
Welcome. And it's a privilege to meet you. And it's a privilege to be cooking for you as well.
Exciting.
We had a chat on the phone and you love experiments with food. You love trying new things.
Yeah.
Music to my ears. So for you, I'm making something that I haven't made before.
That's exciting.
It's exciting for me as well. It's going to be nice and spicy. We're going to go in. It's going to be a spiced chickpeas with a saag, also mm-hmm. known as wilted spinach,
yep.
Some curry leaves, a touch of coconut cream, all put together in a bowl. Very simple. The spices we're going to be using are nigella seeds, mm-hmm. Also known as onion seeds, cumin, mustard, some garam masala, hitting it with some curry leaves, a little bit of red chilli. You all right with the spice?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not one of those people that can literally sort of have the very top spice in Nando's,
fine.
But
yeah,
I do like a little hint.
I love how
it.
You use Nando's as the
I literally sometimes the mango and lime or lemon and herb, I'm like...
Good to know. I think that's like the ubiquitous way in which...
But no, I love
spice.
Seasoning, so it's, yeah.
Good. All right, okay.
Sounds divine. Really
I
does.
Will go for the mango and lime level of spice. Cool, I'm going to crack on this. Tell me a bit about how you cook at home and what kind of things that you like. Like, what's your sort of culinary go-to?
I love anything eccentric and I will literally just go into the cupboard and get everything out and just put them together and see, see if it works, essentially. I only got Instagram a year ago, so I'm quite behind in it.
I start making
all my food look really, really pretty. So I'm getting the wooden slates out and the wallpaper and trying to, you know, and literally my friends are just dying 1,000 deaths, like, what are you doing? Just eat the stuff. I love it. I love eccentric food. I tried a little bit of veganuary. I didn't last, sadly, but I told you that I do a lot of traveling, and I love just trying sort of seasoning and dishes from all around the world. Sushi. Love sushi, Korean food, Japanese food.
I love Korean food.
Yeah.
So I recently flew via Korea to Sydney, and I had a stopover in Seoul, and I flew Korean Airways as well, right? Yeah. So it was just bibimbap the whole way.
Oh,
and honestly,
goodness.
I was in heaven. I was like ordering more food. I was like, yeah, I'll have that Korean version. Because they have like the continental version or like the, you know, Anglo version or whatever the meal is, and it's usually terrible. But the bibimbap was like so, it's like one of the best things I've had in the year. It's
really?
Incredible.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
That's
so cool.
Big fan of Korean food.
So I remember I flew to Thailand and I stopped over in Singapore. So I was on Singapore Airlines.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that, because this is the first time, or the second time I traveled, you know, away on my own. And, you know, you got the food and then they said, oh, do you want to try the Singapore Sling? Which is like a, you know, the cocktail of the country. And I thought you had to pay for it. So I was like, oh no, I'm all right, thank you. And then everyone was getting these Singapore Slings. I was thinking, what am I missing out? And then I realized that I could have got it for free. And I was totally regretting it for my entire trip. So I absolutely made sure I went to go and get a Singapore Sling when I was in the country. But oh my gosh.
Did it make
it
up?
Was,
did it deliver?
It was good. I had it on a beach, so.
Perfect. Are you going to be given anything on the beach? It'll be fine. Yeah.
But yeah, so I love all food, really, honestly. I've actually recently, because I love winter. I love autumn and winter and sort of making really hot stews and curries and just feeling really homely. And I made this black rice porridge with coconut milk and stewed apple and cinnamon. And it was honestly, it was so good.
That
and then, of
incredible.
Course, like me being me, I got some rose petals as well, just to make it look pretty. And my friends were just like, how much do you spend on these flowers? I'm just like, you know, it's part of a dish.
I think rose petals in particular deserve priority because they don't, it's not just about the way they look. They do impart some incredible flavor.
Yeah.
That aroma, that beautiful sweetness.
With the apple as well.
Oh,
it's
totally.
Incredible.
Yeah. I'm going to get you to advise on my next books.
Amazing.
It's clearly you got the visuals down as well as the flavors as well.
And I do photography as well. So,
oh, there you go. There you go. Right.
You've
got multiple professions now. Talking of multiple professions, you've had an incredible experience doing sport as well as your more academic stuff. Now, how did you get into swimming and your most recent passion now, skiing?
So with my swimming, I think I kind of fell into it naturally because my dad was a swimmer at national level.
Oh, wow, okay.
My mum was a gymnast, believe it or not. You saw her at the train station.
Yeah. She's definitely got a height for gymnast.
I hope she doesn't see
it. Definitely, yeah.
Oh, gosh. But yeah, so quite a sporty family.
Oh,
and
wow.
And so I kind of grew up with it. And then being deafblind, someone did come up to me one day and said, oh, have you ever considered swimming for the disability team? I said, oh, you know, I didn't realise that there was, you know, sort of a thing, you know. And believe it or not, sort of, I went to my first national championships in Sheffield when I was 11. I came away with 5 gold and 1 silver.
Oh, my God.
So that was pretty cool. And then from there, I was kind of talent spotted and ended up on the GB team. And it quickly became my life. So I was training twice a day, every single day, land training. In between, I was going to school and doing my homework. And obviously, I permanently smelt of chlorine.
Yeah.
And the house smelt of chlorine as well. And then my sister picked it up as well, that she was swimming. So that was our life. And I can just remember spending many birthdays and whatnot at the swimming pool.
Yeah.
It was just, we were living there, essentially.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, I was getting really bad. I had really bad asthma. And I also had really bad reflux. And when I was swimming, it was kind of really, it was triggering sort of these respiratory episodes. So I ended up sort of being blue lighted to A&E every single night after training. And so I turned into this like all year round Christmas turkey, because they literally just be like sending me in an ambulance in like tin foil in a swimming costume. And it was just like, this isn't a life. It really isn't. So I went for elective surgery, stomach surgery, and it was meant to be pretty straightforward. Long story short, it went very wrong. They damaged the vagus nerve, so I could no longer swallow, could no longer eat. Very quickly, so I went down like 3 stone. And I ended up having 20 stomach surgeries in that year.
Oh, my word.
I had a feeding tube put into the stomach and to the small intestine. And so that by that point, obviously, swimming was over. And then, obviously, at that time, I was of school leaving age. So I couldn't go back to school. So I had to... And at that point, I knew that I wanted to be a doctor, because obviously with my experiences of being a patient for so long.
How old were you at that time?
So I was 16 or 16 and a half. So I was fairly young. But unfortunately, where the hospital I was based at was, so when you're 16, you're classed as an adult. Whereas somewhere else, you know, you might be still on a pediatric ward. So I was on this surgical ward surrounded by sort of much elderly patients. And at times it was really... It was really isolating. And I remember sort of for at least 2 months, I was the only patient on the bay that didn't have dementia.
Oh, wow.
And so every single night, sort of, you know, all the rest and the patient would be screaming out, oh, the police are here, or, you know, going through their list of vegetables. And I just could not sleep. I mean, it's great because I'm hearing impaired. I can just switch my hearing aids off and I don't hear anything. So, but in all fairness, it was a really, it was a tough year and a half. I mean, I don't remember a lot because I was on a morphine pump. At one point I was on an epidural because I was in so much pain. So I was kind of knocked out with all the drugs. I came out and couldn't go back to the school that I was at, and I ended up having to enroll at a blind school, which was residential. And I was there for 3 years, just over 3 years. And it was really good. It changed me as a person. So before, I was very sort of dependent. I didn't have a lot of confidence. Wouldn't go into a shop on my own to buy a chocolate bar or whatever. Wouldn't get on a bus on my own. And then within the first year of this going to this new school, I was on a plane to Africa alone.
Wow.
And so I'd literally changed as a person. And it was great. But academically, it was, sadly, I think we were put into a bubble. Not in a bad way, but I think people wanted to protect us, and they didn't think that we could maybe achieve as much as we could. So
was that because of the assumption that because of your disability, you're limited?
Yeah, exactly. So it would always matter, like, we weren't pushed. We weren't pushed to achieve high, because I guess they just didn't want to have us hurt in, yeah. in society, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The stereotypes.
You can almost empathise with the thinking behind that, even though I don't agree with it. You can you sort of understand it probably wasn't coming out of... it may have not come from a position of... negative
just
don't want to set you up for failure.
It was not malicious at all, and you know, they really, really cared for us. I mean, the school that at the time I was there was only 60 students, so we were like a family. Yeah. it was wonderful. But when I said, hey, I want to do medicine, they just laughed.
Really?
And they said, Alexandra, you can't be a doctor because you're deafblind. Yeah. Don't be so ridiculous. And obviously, I've had stubborn on my school report every single year since about four.
Yes.
And so I was still stubborn at this point. So what did I do? I went the complete opposite end and decided to apply to medical school. But
and what age was that? It was 17,
so 18? I was 18 when I started this school and came out when I was 20, 21.
Gotcha.
And so I was a bit older, but they allowed students on for a little bit longer because of the residential setup. And I had to, because the class, you know, saying that there were 60 students, the class sizes were ranging from 1 to 3 students per class. Mm. And I can just remember in my biology class, it was only 2 of us. And the teachers weren't, I don't want to say equipped, but they just, because they weren't expecting people to sort of take on A-levels and go off to university, they didn't really teach us. So I essentially said to the school, look, I want to go to medical school, and the only way of me doing this is for me to work hard and get my A-level grades. And so I said, look, put me on the exam board or the exam.
Yeah.
I will get some textbooks and I will go away and teach myself. So essentially, in my spare time, I taught myself 3 A-levels. And honestly, it was testing at times. I mean, having gone from being bedridden in hospital for 1.5 years and, you know, completely relying on my parents at home,
yeah.
to moving away, doing my own washing, shopping, cleaning, everything, ironing, and teaching myself A-levels completely by myself was literally just mind-blowing at some point.
But it was a great life lesson. My mind is blown right now. if I didn't have respect for you now, this has gone to a whole nother level. Like, teaching myself A-levels from scratch after having such a traumatizing experience in hospital, being told that you don't have the potential to go into medical school, you have to overcome so many barriers. I'm so glad you're such a stubborn person.
I think it's a good thing at times, it really is.
Oh,
I mean,
definitely,
if I wasn't
yeah.
stubborn, I would not be where I am today, really.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think that stage in my life was a game changer. It really changed my life, without sounding cliche. It was really taught me a lot of lessons, and it threw me into the big wide world. It was almost like a brick in the face, but in a nice brick.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, oh.
And tell me about Africa. I don't think I've heard that before. What did you do over there?
So, pardon?
Tell me about Africa. What was going on?
Oh, so that was really good. I did a gap medics placement, and I'd heard of it. You know, it was an opportunity to get work experience in a hospital, and it was fantastic. And, you know, it was funny because I was almost half expecting the doctors to go, oh, you're visually and hearing impaired, we don't know what to do, which is what has happened as a medical student. Mm. But out there, they were like, oh, come over and do this, come over and do that. And I did all sorts of procedures, you know. It was fantastic.
Oh,
but you know what, it was so funny. I didn't really, because we had to take smart clothes out there, you know, for placement. Oh. And it wasn't until the second week that I was walking down the slope in hospital and I had a bit of a limp. And I looked down and I've got 2 completely different shoes on. One's blue, one's black, one's got a heel, one's flat, one's got a bow and one's got a buckle. And I'm thinking, I've worn these shoes for 2 weeks and no one has told me. Now I thought, they've either not told me because they haven't noticed, or they haven't told me because they don't want to offend me because they think it's a visual impairment thing. Me thinking it was the latter, I then went to everyone and said, oh, look, you know, haha, I got 2 different shoes on. Thinking, no big deal, I'll just go back to my room and change my shoes. These were the only shoes I'd brought to Africa with me.
No.
So I was like this trendsetter wearing odd shoes for the entire trip. It was...
It was so bad.
Did the kids start coughing or something? I can imagine it becoming like a viral thing, like especially nowadays on like TikTok.
You never know.
Yeah, you never know.
Go back and be like, oh yeah, you're wearing different shoes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Fantastic. But no, it was a great experience.
I feel like you could write a book on all the calamities that you were talking about. Some of them earlier, earlier before we jumped on the pod, about the different things that you've had to endure and stuff, and just the fact that you could laugh about it as well. Just it's always a defense mechanism, I think, as well. Like the fact that you can overcome adversity with humor is brilliant.
Yeah, and do you know what? I love not purposely putting myself in these situations, but I love looking back and going, do you know what? Actually, that was really funny.
Yeah.
The number of times I've got lost on my travels, I mean, I got lost in a forest, both in America and in Hong Kong. I'll tell you the Hong Kong story. I wanted to go see Victoria Peak. I say see, like I can't see it, but just to take a load of photos and put them up on Facebook or whatever. And I wanted, because being me, just trying to be different, I wanted to take an alternative route. So instead of taking the tram up, I decided to go to this kind of, you know, out of the blue neighborhood.
Nothing stops you, does it, Alexander? Honestly, like
so anyway, I went looking for this staircase, which I read about on a blog. And I couldn't find it, and I was walking along this road, and I came across this like ladder, which I later found out was a typhoon shelter thing. But I thought it was this staircase that they were talking about. So there's me with my white cane just climbing up this ladder. And then all of a sudden I'm in this like the undergrowth. I'm thinking, oh, okay, like keep positive. I'm probably gonna find the view at the end of this. Not that I'm gonna see this view. So I'm walking, and then all of a sudden, you know when you're in a forest, if you've ever been in a forest, you look around and you go, oh dear, which way did I come? There was no path whatsoever. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh. So I carried on walking, and then my cane, there's a ball at the end of it, and it rolls over when you're kind of going over like an edge. And everywhere I put it, it was going over the edge. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm on a cliff of some sort with all these trees and, you know, didn't. And at the time I didn't have any mosquito spray on and everything. I was literally being nibbled. So I'm thinking, right, I need to get down. So I sat down and I slid off the side of this edge, eventually sort of, you know, ducking all these branches, got to the bottom, and I'm thinking, phew. And then I realized I'm surrounded by this like really high metal fence. And I didn't know whether it was electric or anything. And then I found this little hole about this big down there between
like,
a bramble
like a
bush,
foot big or something.
Literally
yeah.
like a little broken hole. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to like just get on my stomach. And so I wriggled out this little hole. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, thank goodness. And I thought, yeah, I'm at the bottom. Carried on walking, and my cane rolls over another edge, and I hear cars. I'm thinking, oh, civilization at last. Because I genuinely thought, I videoed myself, you know, saying, just in case search and rescue find me at that point. That was the first time I'd ever done this. And so I'm thinking, right, no, I'm going to have to sit down again and slide down this edge. And then I found myself on the hard shoulder of the motorway.
What?
And all these cars are like going beep, and just like, what is this blind person doing on the motorway? And literally, and I thought maybe I should go back into the woods. And there's me trying to climb up the bank, and the soil was.
Oh, God.
And so I had to literally like do the walk of shame down the motorway for about 15 minutes until I found a T junction, crossed the road, and I went back into the subway.
Oh my God, Alexandra, honestly. I almost burnt my food here because I was so engrossed in this story.
I love the food there. It's great.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. Honestly, you could write a book about the adventures of Alexandra. Honestly,
I'm writing a book, so I'm very nearly finished.
And, yeah,
you know, my friends have always told me, "Oh, you're like Bridget Jones, real life," and actually. I could completely relate to every single scene in the Bridget Jones movies. Yeah, I would love to meet Bridget Jones someday. Yeah, I really would.
Yeah.
But no, so I am writing a book. It's more about a memoir of being a deafblind medical student. Mm. But I talk about my experiences as a patient, my sporting background, and I talk about my travels and the palavers I get into in the process. Because I think it's funny, you know.
I think, like I said, it's how you cope. And we cope with humour. We cope with, like, telling stories. stories, the narrative and everything else. And I can't wait to get into that actually in the podcast. Let me take you back to the recipe that I nearly ruined because I was so engrossed in what you were chatting about.
It smells delicious.
I'm so glad. So this is, just to recap, Nigella seeds, mustard seeds, cumin, all cooked down in a little bit of oil. I've used olive, but you can use other nut oils. The chickpeas that are already from a can, I've just drained them. I would cook them from scratch, but sometimes it takes a bit of a while, or it does take a while. Curry leaves, which is the secret ingredient for an authentic sort of Punjabi or Indian dish. The spinach that I've put in, wilted already. And the way I wilt it is just in a saucepan, lid on, no oil, no extra water, just let it wilt and then move it around the pan and then take it off. And that's
for how long?
Around 5 to 6 minutes.
Okay.
And then you just soak up the excess water on a kitchen towel, and then you have a beautiful sort of spinach thing that just that combines wonderfully. And I'm just gonna pop this on the side here.
That looks stunning.
Traditionally, what we would do is serve this with a little bit of yogurt on the side. But I'll just serve it like this for now, so you can have a smell and a taste. I'll give you a spoon.
Oh, it looks incredible. It really does.
I'm glad. I'm really...
I, like I said, you know, I love sort of... I need to get my phone and take...
This is going
on the Instagram.
Oh, really 100%. Definitely going on the gram for sure, mate. For sure. I'll go on YouTube, gram, the whole works. How was your lunch?
It was amazing. It took me so long, but I just speak so long. And
I've never had a guest that's enjoyed the lunch so much to the point where you dragged out the eating. I'm just enjoying savoring every single bite. Honestly, pleasure
so
for someone who's cooked the food, who enjoys, you know, pleasing other people through food. It's the best compliment. So
thank you, Rupi. No, it's just, and for me, like I was saying earlier, being visually and hearing impaired, like, just eating food is just so, it's so essential, isn't it? It is like literally every mouthful, you really like pay attention to what you're tasting, what you're seeing, what you're hearing, it's just, it was beautiful. It was divine.
Because I was quite surprised considering you've had so many operations on your gut and you've had peg feeding, you've had to have like, you know, a slow transition from liquid diet to something that with a lot more variety. A lot of people would see eating as like a chore or something that brings back a lot of bad memories, but not so for you.
I was really desperate to get back to a normal diet, but obviously it was just not knowing how long it would take for the vagus nerve to repair itself. I mean, I still struggle with some foods, and I do have an element of gastroparesis now, but it's just being mindful of how I eat, when I eat, what I eat, but still being able to enjoy it. So I make sure that I have dinner fairly early, so 5:30, 6:30, rather than sort of late at night. And it's the whole sort of little more often rather than like huge meals in one go. But it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy stuff. I mean, I really did not like Ensure drinks. They're just, nutritional drinks, they're disgusting. And I can just remember actually a few months ago, we had like a teaching session at the medical school and they were like, oh, does anyone want to try the Ensure drinks? Like they've got all these like variety of flavours and everyone was getting so excited. And there was me in my chair thinking, you have no idea.
Exactly.
And like when you have to tell your patient, oh, they're really yummy. Like, you know, I recommend this one. And I'm literally saying it through gritted teeth because actually they are the most revolting things I have ever tasted. And actually I do have a garage full of them just in case I have a bad flare up or anything. And then just like, oh no, they just, the stocks don't go down because I just avoid them at all costs.
Yeah. And for the listeners, just describe a bit about gastroparesis and what that means for you.
So essentially it just means that I could eat a normal meal and then, you know, I will be really sick, but it won't be sort of 20 minutes, an hour later. It will literally be 7 or 8 hours later. So as gruesome as it sounds, I could be having chicken for lunch and then sort of at 1 o'clock the next morning, I could be vomiting lumps of chicken. And it doesn't happen all the time, but it's when I have bad flare-ups. It's exhausting and it kind of makes you feel really giddy as well because your sugars go up and down. Like they really sort of... Yeah, it's And it's quite a challenge because when I'm on placement, you never know when you're going to have a good day or a bad day. And then you're thinking, oh, you know, should I eat something or should I wait till I get back because I don't want to be ill this afternoon? So there's all these things that you have to take into account. And sometimes it's really bothersome. But it's just all a complication resulting from all the surgeries. And I've just had to accept that that's happened and just have to live with it, really. But like I said, you know, it doesn't stop me from enjoying food, cooking, eating.
And this is why I just think you're going to be the most incredible doctor when you eventually qualify in the next couple of years, because you can identify so much with patient journeys. You are clearly eloquent and smart enough to do the job and the day-to-day. But people don't realize that medicine isn't about the ability to suture up a laceration or, you know, perform a surgery. It's that emotional connection when you're sat in front of someone and you're trying to empathize.
Yeah.
And through, you know, your disastrous experiences, you can really do that to a level that most other doctors would never be able to. And it's like seeing that sort of positive aspect of your journey over this time. I just think it would be crazy for anyone to think that you couldn't be the most incredible doctor, particularly as you're going to go into palliative care.
I mean, palliative care is, and you've really hit the nail on the head there, because it's one of those fields that it's all about giving empathy and actually sitting down with your patients and treating them as people, you know, working with their families. And I think having experienced being a patient so many times, I totally get, like, for me, I know what's important, what I expect from a doctor. And it's not necessarily, you know, explain to me my blood test results or this is what the scan showed. It's about sitting down and literally just taking a few extra minutes to treat me like anybody else. And it's that common sort of relation that you have with any other human being. And yeah, I do think that my personal experiences of being a patient has helped this. I mean, you know, I remember when I was in hospital for a year and a half, every single day I'd have this big ward round of doctors come round, and it was almost like the end of the bed was like this invisible line.
Yeah.
No one would cross this invisible line. No one would look up, and they'd all look down at the notes and mumble amongst themselves. And I would be in bed like, hello, you know, like, what's going on?
Yeah.
And then they'd move on to the next patient. Yeah. And I was alone. I was isolated. I was scared. And obviously being hearing impaired as well, that was another barrier in itself, because I didn't want to sort of say, excuse me, I didn't hear, knowing that they're rushed off their theatre that is. But then there was this one junior doctor that came back, and she just said three really important words to me. And she just said, are you okay? And I burst into tears and I said no. And that was the first time someone had asked me that question in like 6 or 7 months of me being in that bed.
Wow.
And I said, no, I'm not okay. I'm really scared. I don't know what's going on. And she just got up and closed the curtains around. She said, I know how you feel. And she literally lifted up her blouse and she showed me this huge scar along her ribs. And turns out that this doctor had been in hospital for a long time, at a similar age to me. So she knew what I was going through. But she also taught me that right now she was giving me empathy, and that I would have tons of empathy to give to my future patients. And a few months ago, I was on a ward round. And again, I was at the very back, because there's this supposed hierarchy as a medical student where you're at the very, very back.
It's a weird hierarchy, isn't it? Because you almost fall in line, like, okay, someone goes there, and then the registrar's there, and then you're there, and then you're behind the computer.
Literally.
And you're taking notes and you're running after them, yeah.
Exactly. So I was at the very back and couldn't really see or hear the patient, but I just had this, I can't describe it, but I just had this instinct, this like seventh sense of, you know, this patient isn't happy, something's going on. But again, we're at the invisible line, and no one's really looking up at the patient. And then we move on. And I'm thinking, oh. And at this point, actually, I decided to make my way to the very, you know, front of the crowd. And I just said to the doctor who was leading the consultation, I just said, look, could you speak a little bit louder, because I'm hearing impaired. And unfortunately, and this is one of many of the discriminations I've had, just kind of looked at me up and down and going, walked away and said to his colleague, how do you expect an invalid like her to run the NHS? Now, I heard that. I could have gone up to the doctor and said, excuse me, I heard what you said about me, but I chose not to. I stayed behind and I went back to the other patient that I just had this instinct about. Mm. And I went up to her and I just said, are you okay? And she burst into tears and she said, no, I'm not. And so I did exactly the same as what this junior doctor had done to me. Mm. I got up, I drew the curtains round and I just said, I know how you feel. Because this patient had recently come down onto the ward from intensive care. Mm. And to date, I've had 17 admissions to intensive care as a patient. So 17. It's crazy. I'm actually embarrassed at the number. It's quite bad. But yeah, it was really satisfying to be able to tell this patient that it's all okay. Like, I'm here right now and I'm so much better than what I was. So eventually with time, she will get to that stage too. And just to see her smile, all it took was just a few more minutes just to say that. And actually I realized at that point, I didn't need any vision or hearing for that. I didn't need any blood test results in front of me. I didn't need any scans. All I needed was to sit down and tell this patient that it was all going to be okay. And I say this, and this is my little tagline, but I might not have as much eyesight as most people, but I have more insight than many. And you're so right in saying that it's empathy. Empathy is really, really important in medicine. Mm.
I think most people see medicine, and it's very, very reductionist and naive to think that what we do as doctors is dole out pills or perform surgery or do some other sort of intervention that involves something physical or reading a lab result. The majority of what I do, and this extends to A&E as well, is have meaningful conversations where you establish rapport and you try and get to the sometimes emotional distress as well as the physical distress. Mm-hmm. And to do that as a doctor requires empathy. And if you've ever been a patient, which you've obviously been a patient for a long time and you've had a lot of traumatous experiences. I've had that experience as well, and I had my own heart issues and stuff. Mm-hmm. You understand the vulnerability and how embarrassing it is to be a patient, to be at the end of the bed. I've told this story before on the podcast, but one of the most eye-opening experiences for me wasn't being hooked up to the cardiac monitor, wasn't having all the investigations. It was simply being wheeled from the cardiac unit to the x-ray department to have my chest x-ray through the corridor in the middle of the day. Mm. And I was in my pajamas. I had the porter, I had the nurse with me who had to transport me with the cardiac monitor. And people weren't looking at me. It wasn't like I was being stared at.
Yeah.
But I felt like I was being stared at.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And that will never, ever leave me because I know what it's like to be in the bed at that time. Mm. And if you can tap into that as a health professional, you will become an incredible medical practitioner because you understand at a much deeper level what really medicine involves.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes you realize that you are so vulnerable as a patient, and you can't exactly do anything about it because you can't just get up and go places. You're almost relying on everybody else around you to do things for you when you're so not used to that. Mm. And I totally, when you said that, going in the corridor and in the bed in your pajamas, I totally empathize. And actually, I have been in the hospital as a patient a lot where I'm a medical student. So I see my colleagues who then become my doctors. My medical student friends become the medical students who are taking my history. And honestly, sometimes it can be it's embarrassing, but it exposes you to the real world. And I mean, I guess this again sounds a bit gross, but I remember in one of my ICU admissions, I was really delirious, but it was kind of the phase where I was gradually coming out of the delirium. Mm. So I was vaguely aware of what it was going around me. Mm. But I can remember just having awful runs. And they just said, just go. And I just remember lying in the bed and literally just the feeling of feces coming all the way up to my chest. And honestly, if I was with it, I would be absolutely dying with embarrassment. But honestly, I was so ill, I just didn't care. But listening back to it, it was But it makes you realise that, you know, when a patient goes, oh, I really don't want to use a commode, I don't want to use a bedpan, I totally get why. Yeah. I totally understand. Rather than say, oh, don't be silly, you know, it's fine.
100%.
You need to be able to sit down and say, look, I've had this really embarrassing experience. I mean, back when I was a patient on for that year and a half, I can remember, I was bedridden for most of the time. But I can remember before having an epidural in, I was put on to a commode and I literally had nothing on, not even a gown.
For the listeners, a commode is like a portable toilet.
Yes, so it's basically, and it's got like a, it's like a chair almost, and you just sit on it and, and they take the box pan away. But so I had nothing on and the nurse had forgotten to put the brakes on.
Oh, no.
And so I was literally so weak at this point. I literally heaved myself into this commode and out I go.
Oh, no.
Wheeling into the middle of the corridor. I mean, I was on a surgical ward, but at the time, like, four out of the five patients had dementia, so I really hope that they don't literally remember what
they won't remember.
But,
that.
but for me, with the doctor seeing through the window and everything, and as a young 16-year-old girl, I couldn't have been so more embarrassed, honestly. It was...
Alexander, the number of stories you've got, honestly, like... We still need to go back to the Tanzania story as well, but you just pull out all these stories again and again, and like, I've been you know, in good humour, chatting to you about this for the last couple of hours now. I just can't believe how many you've got.
It's crazy. It's honestly.
Howlers.
Where do you want me to start?
I don't know.
I mean, with Tanzania, it was, because that was my first ever.
Okay.
That was my first ever trip. I mean, I was saying to you earlier over dinner that before I went to this blind school, I was literally so dependent on my parents, and I didn't have any confidence. I wouldn't go anywhere on my own, wouldn't even take the bus. And then within my first year of going to this school, I was gallivanting around the world on my own. But oh my goodness, Tanzania was so funny. So as I was explaining, now I excuse if it's rude, I'm so sorry, but I was on placement and the doctors were amazing. They really tried to get me involved, you know, despite my disabilities. And they would go, oh, Alexandra, come over and do this and come over and do that. And I had a week in internal medicine and a week in surgery. And I was in surgery and the doctor came up to me and said, oh, Alexandra, do you want to come over and do this circumcision? Now, at the age of that, then I had never heard of the word circumcision before because I'm quite a naive person at this point. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Like, really want to get involved.
Like a key medical student.
Yeah, literally. So they scrubbed me up and put me in my gown and put my mask on. And then I realised evidently what I was about to do. And I was like, oh, okay. And for this, I think this patient was having recurrent infection. Uh-huh. So it was for medical purpose. Yeah. And the doctor, you know, told me what to do. But the funny thing was that the other students who were doing the procedures in the other room were doing it at arm's width like any other surgeon would. But me being visually impaired, I was literally like an inch away. And this poor patient was only under local anaesthetic. So he was completely aware that there was this blind, untrained, not even medical student at this point, operating on his penis. And I was just like, mumbo. I kept putting my thumbs up and I felt so bad for him. But, you know, it was so funny because I was genuinely convinced that this doctor would be like, no, you can't do this, you're visually impaired. But he encouraged me. In fact, he said I had a really steady hand and he told me to come back and do the other patient's procedures. And I was like, oh my goodness. So anyway, the story continues. I went away on a safari weekend, just to kind of like wind down off of placement. And on the side of the safari park were, you know, there are cottages where we're all staying. And the cottages are each named after an animal local to that area. And knowing my luck, my cottage was called Dick Dick Cottage. And honestly, I told you this was rude. I had no idea what a Dick Dick was. So obviously I went around asking what it was. And apparently it's this kind of... it's kind of like a kangaroo. It's an animal that jumps, and you know, I'd never heard of it before. And I thought, oh, great! And anyway, had a fantastic weekend. And you know, fast forward to home, I couldn't take the bus with everyone else, and it was a 9-hour drive to the airport because my flight was at a funny time. So the program manager had offered to take me personally in his car to the airport. And I thought, oh my goodness, that's so kind of you. And his three other brothers were also going to the airport. But it wasn't until it was like 4 hours in that I realised that I was in the back of a Jeep in the middle of a desert with four men I didn't really know.
Yeah.
But it was fine. It was fine. And then we stopped, and we were literally in the middle of nowhere. And one of the brothers in the front, he got out, and he was just facing, you know, the horizon, sort of back to me, sort of thing. And obviously he was having a toilet break.
Okay, yeah.
But me being visually impaired, I couldn't quite see that. So I thought he was admiring the view. So I go, what a lovely view. And then the brothers look at me like, you're a bit weird. Like, anyway, so I'm just looking around, completely oblivious, whilst this the guy's on his toilet break, literally within my full vision, yeah. You know, of what I had. And anyway, so I saw a few zebras sort of like potter around. And then, because for me, I can only see shapes from a distance. Uh-huh. I saw this thing like jumping up and down in the background. And I said, oh, look, it's a tick tick. Whilst he was on his toilet break, honestly. And they literally must have thought I was so rude. And then I needed a toilet break. And me being like a censor, I'm so sorry.
My stories just carry on and on.
I'm so gullible. I'm so naive. And literally, I was like, when we get to the next service station, can I please stop so I can go to the toilet? And they said, yeah, sure. They don't have service stations in Tanzania, literally. And so it was another 4 hours until we stopped. And we stopped in this, like, lorry park. Uh-huh. It was not, like, you know, the usual toilets you'd expect in sort of the Western world. Mm. And anyway, they dropped me off and they pointed me to where the toilets were. And it was literally this hole in the floor. And there wasn't even a door to sort of shield you. It's literally just kind of like a barred gate, if you like. And anyway, I'm sort of getting used to this whole crouching down thing. Yeah. But honestly, it was so hard to relax. And yeah. I was desperate for the toilet. And I wasn't wearing a skirt, which is probably the most inconvenient of things. So anyway, I'm squatting for at least 5 minutes. Going, come on, I just need to go. I'm desperate. Please relax. And then just about as I was going to go, the guy, the driver, called, Alexandra, are you okay in there? And literally lost my nerve altogether and literally wet myself. And it went everywhere. And I had to waddle out back into this lorry park in front of all these people with a clearly very dark patch, like soaking through my trousers. And I had to sit in the poor guy's car for like another few hours. So I eventually got on the plane unscathed. But oh my goodness, it was... But literally, I'm not joking. Every time I go traveling, I get myself into a palaver. Like in America, so this again was another spur of the moment thing. I decided that I was just going to go on a mission and find some blind and deaf doctors because I think at that point I'd got to the end of another year in medical school where I was experiencing discrimination and people weren't really approving of, you know, me studying medicine, essentially.
What year was this?
So this was the end of year two.
Okay.
So I decided again within a few days, booked flights, managed to find these doctors all across America and said, look, can I come and shadow you for a few days, you know, learn how you do it, what you do. And it was honestly the most eye-opening, excuse the pun, eye-opening experience ever. And anyway, I only had one day off. Uh-huh. And this was when I was in San Francisco. So I decided to explore the area. And of all things, I decided to go whale watching.
Whale watching?
Whale watching. I mean, what visually impaired person goes whale watching? Like, but it's fine. I hopped onto a boat into the Pacific and spent a day, you know, and it's so interesting because everyone else on that boat was being seasick. They were vomiting overboard. But with my hearing impairment, we found actually a few years ago that my balance organs are fused together, which would explain why I can't stand on one leg.
Right. Yeah.
But I think it must affect my ability to not be car sick and seasick. So I was the only person sat in there like smiling away, like, this is a great trip. Everyone else was literally going green. But when I got off the boat after my little whale watch. There were no whales. Whale watching tour. I decided to go because it's really famous for the redwoods and the sequoias. The trees.
Yes.
And so I decided that I was going to go and look at these trees. Again, it was very visual. Me wandering around with a white cane, it was absolutely fine. And I remember going up to this. So I got into an Uber and it was almost like we went over this sort of, not a mountain, but it was in the middle of nowhere, essentially. It was a forest. And I'd got to the entrance, which was literally just this wooden cabin. And I said, do you have tactile maps? So because I can't see the normal ones, I said, do you have any for me to access as a visually impaired person? They said no, but if you just stay on like the wooden path, you'll be fine. It just goes all the way around and back. I said, okay, no problem. But me being so fascinated by these, like, honestly, these beautiful giants, within 15 minutes of walking, I suddenly realized, because this is how in the clouds I become, I suddenly realized I was walking up this muddy bank and I had completely gone off course, and I was no longer on this wooden path. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm lost. I mean, this is like this Hong Kong story all over again. Mind you, this happened before Hong Kong, so I have a habit of getting stuck in forests.
You didn't learn your lesson.
But I thought I saw someone, and I said to them, I said, look, I'm so sorry, I'm visually impaired, I've got a little bit lost, do you know which way to go? And obviously I didn't get a response because it was a tree trunk. So I had to carry on walking, and eventually I got back onto the path got to the exit. And then I went back up to this wooden hut, and I really wanted to say, you really should get some tactile maps out, for people like me. But I don't know whether they have many blind people walking around forests, so maybe not.
Unaided. Without company.
Exactly. Yeah. So anyway, I said, look, is there Wi-Fi? Because I need to book an Uber. Mm. And they just laughed at me. Because we were literally in the middle of nowhere. Of course, there wasn't going to be Wi-Fi. So I said, is there a taxi rank? And they were like, no. And I said, is it walkable? And they really laughed at me then. And I was like, okay, clearly not. But thing is, everyone else who had come to this national forest had come on those sort of multiple day tours. So they were all on sort of booked on coaches. And obviously, I couldn't get on a coach because I wasn't part of any tour. So I essentially just started walking down the road. And I never done this in my life before, and obviously you've got to be so careful.
Yeah.
But my only option was to hitchhike, and I literally just it was an adventure. I wouldn't have told my parents there and then.
I can imagine.
But it was, and I actually ended up sort of being blessed and driven down back to the harbour, Sausalito, which is beautiful.
Yes, yeah, Sausalito, because
by a family from Washington, and they were so nice and they were so understanding. I think they'd obviously driven themselves there, so managed to get out of that one. And then when I I was in Sausalito, and I was staying with some friends of a friend for those 2 days that I was in the area. And I thought, it would be really, really nice to buy them some flowers to say thank you. And I didn't realize that the florist at the shop was shut, and as in closed.
Yeah.
And I walked in, and what I thought was the front door. And it was like this door to a refrigerator, which had kind of like these special plants in.
Right.
And literally, I just sort of got stuck in this refrigerator. And the owner of the shop literally came out and started shouting really, what do you think you're doing? They're enclosed and all this and that. And I said, please, please. And I literally got my cane out. I said, I'm blind. Like, I didn't realise. And then all of a sudden, she literally changed completely her tone. She said, oh, it's fine. Like, let me explain. And then, honestly, she spent the next hour describing every single flower to me. I was like, okay, this is a bit too much. I went home with my flowers. It was fine, eventually. But anyway, so the next day I had to fly back to New York because the doctors I'd met were in New York and San Francisco. And I was flying Virgin America. So it was an in-country flight, so you didn't get food, and you just had to pay if you wanted some. And I decided, it's fine, I can stick it out till I get there. But the guy next to me was morbidly obese, and literally his one leg was literally on top of my lap, and he'd ordered himself like a 7-course meal. And in all honesty, it looked really good. I know we were talking about flight meals earlier.
Yeah.
But his first course was tomato soup. And I can't honestly remember like sort of visualizing it at full speed, but in slow motion, there was this slight bit of turbulence, and somehow this bowl of tomato soup just managed to go up in the air quite seamlessly, turn round, and land in my crotch. Nowhere else, just in my crotch, literally. And I was just covered in tomato soup in the worst area possible. It was nowhere else. And then this guy just said to me, "Oh my God, that was my tomato soup." And I literally, he did not apologize. He just said he was more worried about his starter. Oh, no. And so I had to waddle out into John F. Kennedy Airport with a massive red patch in between my legs. I was just dying a thousand deaths, honestly.
I'm sure you've got another story that started when you were in JFK. Okay. This all started from the delirium that you were experiencing in ICU, which you've got to get back to. But I just, honestly, I've just sat here listening and I just cannot wait for your book to come out, because it's like an Adam Kay on steroids. It really is, honestly. And it just, you know... Brilliant. But let's divert to...
We'll divert
back. So I think we should definitely come back to all your experiences with the other... were they visually impaired as well as hearing impaired?
Yes. Doctors, so I met one deaf doctor and five blind doctors. Amazing. And incredible. You know, and actually it was the reaffirmation that what I was trying to do was really possible. Mm. And I was able to go home and say to my own medical school, look, there's other people out there who are doing this, and they're doing it by doing things this way. So for instance, one of the blind doctors I met, and I'm really good friends with them all, and I really hope that one day I can go back out to the US and have a reunion. And he was just saying to me, he was so clever in everything I said to him. He just had an answer for everything. Absolute genius. And he just said to me, or rather I said to him, you know, what if, theoretically, I wanted to become a psychiatrist? If I can't read an x-ray, theoretically, then I will never be able to be a psychiatrist, even though I will probably never, ever look at an x-ray in that specialty. Yeah. And he just said to me, have you ever gone up to a doctor who wears contact lenses or glasses and asked them to remove them? Can they still insert the cannula? Can they still read the x-ray with precise vision? You know, can they still do this and that? The answer is probably no, but we don't see that as disability. And it's just really interesting, because as soon as you see something visible, like a white cane or hearing aids, people just immediately assume that you are incapable. And I think as a society, we are very used to kind of just being negative without sounding negative. We kind of just jump to the conclusion that things aren't doable. You know, we're pessimists. And that's when I think that I don't feel involved in society, because I'm actually quite an optimist. I say, hang on a minute, you know, there is a solution to this. Yeah. There's always a solution to anything. And I just think it's so important we pay attention to that, because there are ways. Mm. And then obviously when I was seeing the deaf doctor, even I was interested, this is, you know, how does he hear not only his patients, but how does he hear things like the heart, the lungs, you know, the bowel sounds through a stethoscope? And literally, it's amazing, because I have one of my own now. He uses a Bluetooth stethoscope, so he does not put anything in his ears, and it's literally just the bell, the end of the stethoscope. It's all high tech. You literally just switch something on your hearing aids and ta-da. You can hear someone's heart without even putting it anywhere near your ears. And I think it's incredible, because people think I have super hearing. I just need x-ray specs now. And then I am absolutely sorted. But, you know, it is. It's technology. And actually, when people ask me, oh, you know, so what's your biggest barrier doing medicine as a deafblind person? Well, I say, well, actually, it's not my disabilities. It's people's ignorances. It's people's sort of unwillingness to accept who I am, and not being willing to sit down and say, okay, so how can we come up with a solution for this? So it was a very inspiring, eye-opening trip. Really gave me a lot of insight.
This is precisely why I wanted you to come on the pod, not purely because you're breaking barriers by being the UK's first blind and deaf doctor. But because you inspire us and everyone around you to think much more positively and to not limit ourselves, what you said about contact lenses, it really does paint a true picture of how we think very pessimistically about everything in our lives. And I think we're trained to do that from a young age. And I'd love to hear a bit more about how, like, your upbringing may have encouraged you to be stubborn and to be more sort of like adventurous. It sounds like you are very adventurous. But I think if we are much more solutions focused and actually what we want to achieve, we will eventually get there, whether it be through high tech solutions, whether it be, building on the paths that other people have done, like the deaf and blind doctors that you met in the US.
Yeah, and I think it's also just a cultural shift as well. We 100%. Do need to be more accepting of each other, because until we do that, we are never going to, and I'm so sorry I keep using these puns, but we're never going to open our eyes to the real possibilities. I don't mean to do this, but going back to my traveling, when I was sort of stuck in these situations, like lost in a forest, there was no point me sitting on the ground and crying, because really that is not going to solve anything. The only way out was to be optimistic and say, right, I'm going to carry on walking until I literally get to the end of a tunnel.
Yeah.
And it's the same concept for everything else in life. And for me, I apply that every day in medicine. You've just got to keep walking it. You've just got to keep going. And you will eventually get there, no matter how rocky that journey is. And I think this kind of represents my entire life in a way, because hopefully at the end I'll get to this beautiful destination, which is I'm going to qualify as a doctor and I get to help people. But I don't think you can truly get to a beautiful destination without taking a really rocky journey. I don't think the journey is as simple, as beautiful as the final thing. And that's certainly the case for me. You know, I've had a very up and down, rocky journey in life. But I wouldn't change any of that, because, like I was saying earlier, it's given me so much life experience, which actually, okay, at the time might have been really traumatic for me, but in the long, in the grand scheme of things, in the long term, it is going to benefit so many other people, because I can give that empathy and I can give that example and I can share my experiences.
Absolutely. You're a beacon holder for so many people. I remember listening to your TED talk, and you told that story of the child who sat next to you with a disability.
Yes,
and he was, naturally being not ridiculed, but he was being told he can't achieve what he wanted to do, which is to go into medicine.
Yeah, he'd already been put in that little bubble.
Yes.
That little sort of stereotype. And it's all about tick boxes in society at the moment. Oh, he doesn't tick the I'm able to hear. And it made me so mad. And like I said, I don't normally barge into conversations, but I really did have to. I felt like it was my place to say something.
What did you say to the boy?
So essentially, this little boy called Tim came and sat next to me on the underground, and he publicly announced to his mother and the rest of a train carriage that he wanted to be...
Very un-British thing
to do. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He must have been about 7 or 8, I think, bless. But he just announced that he wanted to be a doctor when he grew up. And I thought, oh, great, in my mind. But his mum just laughed and said, but Tim, how are you going to heal the poorly people? And Tim sank down into his seat with disappointment. And I just looked to my side and I noticed that he'd got hearing aids. And like I said, I don't normally barge into conversations. It's not a thing to do on the underground. People just kind of keep their heads down and don't talk to each other. But I couldn't help but personally empathise with Tim. So I leant in and I pointed to his and my hearing aids. And I said, you can be anything you want to be. This is your superpower. And I don't know where Tim is now, but I really hope that he takes that advice and he always dreams big and reaches for his dreams, really. I just hope that one day he gets to be the doctor that he does want to be.
Absolutely. And I think one day he'll watch your story as well and, remember you were that girl on the train who told him to reach for the stars. And I think it speaks very much to the topic of your incredible TED talk that I'll make sure I link to in the podcast notes, of how we make judgments on other people, yes, but also on ourselves. We do limit ourselves. We're like, you know, I can't be a doctor, or I can't, you know, run that Ironman, or I can't do this because other people will ridicule me. And on a macro level, you know, you are living testament to how you can actually overcome huge, huge barriers. I mean, the thought, if I'm being very honest, and this speaks to my ignorance, I wouldn't have thought it would have been possible for someone who is deaf and blind to work in the profession, because I'm limited by what I think a doctor should be able to do. So I'm, you know, I'm very much guilty of the same thing. And you are proving me and many, many others wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's, and it's so good to you know, speak about this openly.
Yeah. And I think that for most people, it's not, like in your case, it's not that you're being malicious. It's not being like, oh, you can't be part of this workforce. It's literally just there isn't anybody else out there who is deaf blind in the UK who are in the field, and so therefore we're just oblivious to it. We just don't know. So you're right, I think it's all about just making it a very open topic of conversation to say, look, actually this is doable, this is how I'm doing things, and this how we can help other people in a similar situation to me achieve their dreams in medicine. Because there is, and it's a spectrum, isn't there? You know, when you think of blindness, well, actually it's not just either I see everything or I see nothing. There's absolutely everything in between. So for instance, with my vision, I've got just under 5% in the left eye centrally and nothing else. I don't have any vision in my right eye. And that sounds really bad on paper. But then there's me going off, I go running, I go skiing, I go travelling around. Okay, yes, I do get lost in a few forests every now and then. But, you know, I'm very independent. But if you saw that on paper, you think, whoa, I wouldn't even get from room to room in the house. And it's the same thing with my hearing. So I am classified as having severe to profound hearing loss, but I don't sound like a typically deaf person. When I take my hearing aids out, I'm completely and utterly deaf, which honestly is the most advantageous thing ever. Apart from when the fire alarm goes off in the middle of the night, that's not so good.
Right.
But it's just about trying to help people understand what that really means. Because I can just remember, I had a bit of a media storm before Christmas, and, you know, doing loads of radio and television interviews. And, you know, you get a lot of comments naturally, and most of them were really positive. But I can remember, you know, there were a few people that, you know, just did not approve at all. And one person commented on one of my interviews, and bearing in mind it was a live interview on national television, face to face with a presenter. And he said, how can I communicate with patients if I am deaf? Like, that's just not possible. But surely me having a face-to-face interview with someone on live TV, wasn't that enough to kind of prove that I can talk, yeah. I can hear, I can hold a conversation? So yeah. I don't normally, I, you know, I get so many comments, I just have to kind of just brush past the negative ones. But I did feel like I needed to just explain.
Yeah.
So I messaged him back, and I think I maybe made my point.
Yeah.
He didn't get back to me after that. So I was like,
I think every now and then, I think we have to indulge in entertaining ourselves and actually responding to some of the negative comments. But as a general rule of thumb, like, I've learned to ignore and to carry on with the mission. And your mission, obviously, is very clear. Mm. I think it just speaks to, you know, how measured you are. I mean, I couldn't even imagine the amount of negativity that you've had in the past. And the way we speak about it now, and I think I should make this clear, is it's almost like you're over the hurdle. It's like you've got there, you're in medical school and you're on your way. Mm. Actually, this is something you deal with on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
And from what you were telling me about, even when you went into medical school, you had the acceptance letter, and then you had a rejection.
Yes. So I got an initial place at a medical school, and I remember between getting my offer in April and getting my results in August, I went up to this medical school 5 times in person. And I basically just said, look, are you sure you can have me? Are you sure you're able to support me as, you know, a student with additional needs? Because, you know, I was being realistic. I knew that it was going to be way harder. But I just wanted to make sure that it was possible and that I was going to the right place. And all along they were telling me it was absolutely fine. All the support was ready. They were looking forward to having me. And so then I got higher grades in August and what they'd asked for. So I thought, oh my goodness, brilliant. You know, I've actually done it. I am going to medical school. And I can clearly remember the excitement. You know, you probably can remember those days where you go and you buy your crockery. Like, I love my crockery, obviously. Your bed sheets and everything to go with the pasty university halls, you know, everything. And then a week before moving into accommodation, bearing in mind this was mid-September, I literally just received a phone call one evening from this medical school saying, sorry, we've changed our minds. We don't want you anymore because you're disabled. And just like that, they'd put the phone down and I was left with nothing for a whole year. And I can clearly remember for about 3 weeks, I could not talk to anyone. I was so... I think I'd very quickly gone past the, oh my goodness, I'm devastated. I was angry.
Yeah.
I was like, how could an educational institution discriminate like that? I mean, bearing in mind that I had, you know, so many times gone up to this medical school and said, are you sure? Are you absolutely 200% sure? And time again, they were saying it was fine. And then they said that the last minute. I just thought it was honestly... But then, of course, I remediated that by going travelling again. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just you talking about it, honestly, great. Like, I'm angry thinking about it. Mm. That really does make my blood boil. Just so frustrating, the fact that you've done everything in your power, you've checked with them again and again, and then for them to just brush you aside with huge, huge discrimination. I mean, we won't name the medical school, but, like, you know, it's just... It's embarrassing for anyone, part of any institution that represents medics and you know, future people, doctors.
People just come up to me and said, why don't you like take it further? Why don't you sort of, like, I don't know, investigate why this happened? But then, and this was the point where, you know, in the 3 weeks where I was just so down in a dark place, my parents said to me, look, you know, and these, you know, my parents are my greatest supporters. And they've always said, you know, go, you know, achieve your dreams. But they were the ones who actually then sat down and said, look, well done for trying, but maybe this is a sign it's just not going to work. But me being stubborn, like I said to you earlier, I had this instinct to give it one more go. Now, I didn't want to take this up. I didn't want to sort of fight against what had just happened because I didn't want to be wasting my energy on the bad stuff. I wanted to be putting all my eggs in one basket, and that basket was to get... into medical school for good, which I'm so glad I did, because if I hadn't gone with that instinct, I think instincts is a very powerful, special thing, actually. Had I not gone with that, I don't know where I would be now. But I was very lucky to get into medical school the year after.
I think that, you know, speaks to where you channel your energy, right? You could have channeled everything at trying to, you know, take them to court on discrimination grounds. You would have had so many grounds to do that, but instead... You were like, no, I'm not going to allow this to destroy my dream. I'm not going to put my negative energy to that. I'm going to actually put my energy into what I believe is achievable for me. Exactly. And I'll make that happen. Yeah. And you are manifesting it by where you put your energy. And this is exactly why, to at a much less severe degree, you don't want to waste your time replying to negativity in the physical world, in the social world, online. You want to put everything, all the energy into something that's going to further you and help you achieve your personal mission.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, there are 7.53 billion people in this world. There are so many places, so many things to do, so many years of life. And I just think, you know, just make the most of it in a good way. Don't sweat the small stuff. Why would I even bother trying to pursue something? You know, tried to get back into a medical school, but are clearly not going to support me, even if they did change their mind. You know, so I was very lucky to get into another medical school a year later. But then again, you'd think that actually it was all fine and dandy from there. But actually, it only got worse. And it made me realise very quickly that this is what I was going to be facing for... you know, quite possibly the rest of my career. And although it has at times really reduced me to the ground, the way I see it, I like to try and be positive as I can. The way I see it is that, you know, at least on my first day as a junior doctor, I am not going to crumble by the slightest, you know, sort of discrimination or comment or, you know. So in a way, it's equipping me for the real world, yeah. But still, it's some of the stuff that's been said to me has been really unacceptable. And I think actually that's kind of when I really started my journey in terms of sharing my voice. So the TED Talk, the blogging, the book. Because before medical school, I was... Like, I know I wasn't very confident, but actually the only thing that I did have confidence in was with who I was and what my disabilities meant. You know, I was totally fine with going around with my white cane. I loved doing sport. I didn't let anything hold me back. But then actually starting medical school was the point that I was reminded every single day that I was different to everybody else. But I was reminded in a bad way. I can remember in the first term of medical school, I was called into a meeting and the meeting was on the first floor. And so I went up into the stairs, and as I went into the room, the staff member basically said, oh, be careful of the corners of the tables. They're really, really sharp and we don't want you bumping into them and causing more paperwork. So this was in, 60 seconds of meeting me. So they had already assumed that I was this clumsy, reckless person. And that was quite patronising, but I thought, actually, no, maybe they're just trying to... They're just, you know, caring. And I can remember having this meeting, and at the end, I really wanted to make a statement. So I ran down these stairs, and I got to the bottom, fine. And then the hallway was quite dark, and I'm night blind, so I couldn't quite see where the door handle was. So very subtly, I just sort of skimmed my hand across the door to feel where the handle was. And this staff member was at the top of the stairs and basically said, and how do you expect to become a doctor if you can't find the door handle? And from that day on, I felt so embarrassed to use my white cane. I can remember going into future meetings and not wanting to look at my phone because I didn't want to be seen looking at it like too close. I didn't want to give away any sort of evidence that I was disabled. And I was very quickly losing my own identity, and it was awful. I hated it. So I'd gone from being this person that was totally accepting of my own disabilities to not just wanting to blend in, essentially. But actually, since going to America, yeah, I've realised that actually, and it goes back to what I said to Tim, my white cane and my hearing aids are actually my superpowers, and I need to use them because actually patients like doctors with superpowers, not as in being superhuman, but just being able to use the very basics, yeah, of what resources they have, what emotional sort of intelligence they have to use to talk to their patients. And it's great. I mean, I've had evidence of, you know, I was actually on geriatrics recently for my placement, and you'd think that I'd get the discrimination from my patients, but actually my patients are wonderful. Yeah. It's my colleagues that I get it from. Wow. But these elderly patients, bless them. I mean, one of them was, I think, quite delirious on that day. But he genuinely thought I was carrying around a drumstick, uh-huh, which was my cane. Uh-huh. And he said, oh, you know, where's the rest of your band? I said, oh, I'll bring my band on Friday. I'll make some music on the ward. And then another one thought I was seeking treasure, like a treasure detector, right, along the hospital floor, which was quite funny. And then and this patient will always, always stay in my mind. And actually, I talk about him in my book. Mm. Obviously, I've changed the names and everything. Yes, but yeah, he was a palliative patient. And I really want to go down palliative medicine. I just think it's such a special field. And he looked at me and he said, you're blind. And that was the first time any patient had said that to me. Because he knew what that white cane was. Not many people, surprisingly, know what a white cane means. But anyway, I went up to him and said, yes, I am. You know, I'm visually impaired and this is what I can see, this is what I can't see. And we just had this really lovely chat. And it turns out that back in the day, his job was, it involved installing the tactile road surfaces. Oh, you know, so when you go to a traffic light, you have all the sort of the bubbles on the floor. It's to tell you that you're about to approach a road or, you know, the stairs. And so he knew all about it, and he was fairly weak, and in fact he was waiting for a fast track home, basically to die. And I just said, look, you know, and I folded my white cane and I put it in his hand from where he was lying in the bed, and I said, this is how you use it. So I was sort of swaying it from side to side, and oh, it was, and the smile on his face was something I will always, always remember. And you know, for me, it's not the satisfaction from working out a diagnosis. For me, it's literally just making a patient smile. I think it's the best thing ever. And anyway, I said to the team, I said, look, I really want to do palliative medicine. So if I get any opportunity to follow this patient up, please, can you let me know? Because actually, it's really shocking. In medical schools, we do not get much exposure to death and dying through palliative care. And so I was very lucky. The hospice nurse got in touch and said, I'm going to be visiting this patient. Would you like to come with me? And I said, oh, absolutely. So kind of, it was actually my day off. And I was like, no, I'm going to go. I really, really want to see him. And went to the house, and his family had come over, and he was at the point where it was like the active dying process, essentially. He couldn't open his eyes. He was very weak. He wasn't talking, but I think he was still aware that we were around. So I held his hand, and then I thought, ooh. And I got my cane and I folded it up and I put it under his hand, and you could just see his grip tighten around the white cane. And I just hope that, I think he knew that I was there, and he died the next day. But I'm just so, so glad that I got to see him before. And it just made me realize, actually, this white cane, it is a superpower, and actually I should be proud of who I am and what I am and what this is. And you know, I can't let people's derogatory comments, you know, bring me down. I need to use it to change perceptions in a good way.
Absolutely. It's taken my breath away just listening to that story. I'm kind of speechless. I'm going to have a minute, I think.
Crying, laughing. Sorry, all sorts of emotions.
No, I know. It's like, it's definitely a roller coaster chat, you know, you know, one thing that really strikes me is like, how on earth did you muster the incredible psychological strength to overcome the discrimination of and the ridicule of, like, not being, you know, someone saying you can't even open the door, how on earth are you going to be a doctor? Those are like, and that's on the back of you having to jump all those hurdles of like getting the high of the medical acceptance letter and then being put back another year, and yes, having to go traveling, you had some great times, but then going back into the same process.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, on a daily basis, just absolute grind. Mm. Like, how have you developed that incredible mental strength and the, you know, the marathon, the energy that you need to do that on a daily basis?
I'm not going to lie, there's been times where I've really broken down and thinking, oh my goodness, can I really do this? But I think it would be very unnatural and unhuman if you didn't do that. I think everyone has to have a cry. Everyone has to feel vulnerable and weak at times. It's totally normal. I think the thing that's got me through is positivity, and think that actually, okay, look at all the terrible things that have happened. Use that as a life story that will just give you so much more experience to help other people. And I mean, it's been tricky because the discrimination I got, actually, I got a few months of it, just day after day after day. And this all began on my first day of full-time placement in the clinical environment. So years one and two, we were sort of in and out of lectures. And then year three, it was in the hospital all the way through. And that was the year that I'd recently come out of ICU in Italy, where I had horrendous delirium. I was on life support for 3 weeks. I had sepsis and pneumonia. And my parents had to sign for a tracheostomy. Thank goodness I didn't have to have one in the end. Yeah. But they were essentially told...
A tracheostomy is where you put a pipe...
A hole in the throat, yeah, like a breathing tube. And they were essentially told that I would be going home in a box. So anyway, I had really awful, awful delirium, which I can come back to in a minute. But I had to start placement a little bit later than everybody else. But in a way, my mechanism of coping was to get back to medicine. I couldn't stand sitting at home and just kind of sitting there and not really knowing what to do with myself. I was really weak. I was being tormented by these flashbacks and not being able to sleep. I just needed to go back. But obviously when I did, that's when all the discrimination happened. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, it is literally one thing after another. I mean, with the going back to the delirium, seeing that we're on the topic, it's very different to having a nightmare, because you don't just see it, you hear it, you feel it, you smell it, you taste it. It is literally like a 3D experience, essentially. And it's so real. It is real. And for me, it was kind of like this jumble of being in a plane crash, spewed out onto a concrete runway. And I can still remember the heat of the concrete as I lay in on this tarmac, but I couldn't get up. I was like a jelly. I thought that my jaw had dislocated and, you know, it was metal poles, you know, being, and obviously in theory, they were just, it was the ventilator and the tubes in my nose and everywhere else. And I thought I was hanging off the edge of a building for days. I thought I was at my funeral. I didn't recognize my parents. So I remember them saying, "Who am I?" And I literally had dysphonia. I couldn't tell them. I could not tell them. I thought I was in the year 2024. I didn't know who I was. I'd forgotten that I'd had a sister. Really, really, really bad stuff. I think the only uplifting thing I can remember about the delirium is that I was convinced, and I was on holiday in Italy at the time, so for the context, I was convinced that this really good-looking Italian man had come to visit me every single day. And I'm convinced that we'd fallen in love. And I got home and I said to Mum, I said, "I literally can't find Ricardo in any of my social media contacts." Like, he even had a name. And I was like, "Where on earth is he? Like, what was his surname?" And my mum was like, "I'm so sorry to break the news, but no one came to visit you." I was so disappointed. But yeah, so obviously, I don't really know when the delirium happened, where, because I was in two different hospitals. I had to be transferred to another one because my condition was quite bad. But yeah, my parents had to fly out to come and see me, because obviously it was quite a difficult situation. And unfortunately, they got themselves stuck into a bit of a situation too. I'm not sure if you heard about the Genoa bridge collapse, but a big bridge in Italy collapsed
this.
And yes. Killed 43 people.
Yes.
My parents drove over that bridge 2 hours before it went.
Oh my.
So they flew into Genoa and got a hire car down to the first hospital. And the thing is, they had told me of their ordeal whilst I was on the ventilator. So I must have been still very delirious. Mm. And so I did. I had this, one of my deliriums was not only the plane crash, but also I was in this car wreckage and the driver hadn't made it and I'd somehow survived. And it was so confusing, because I genuinely, when I came round and I was able to speak, I said to Mum, I said, "Why am I in hospital? Like, what's happened to me?" I had no clue. I mean, I thought I was in a skiing accident, a car crash, a plane crash, all sorts. But anyway, so I then had to obviously go back to med school, and actually I just wanted to go back. And I can just remember sitting at home, just twiddling my thumbs almost, and seeing the news, and it was just all negative stuff. And actually I saw a clip on the news of these cars dangling off a bridge. And I couldn't do it. I literally just had to go back and focus on something. Mm. But then my mum had to stay with me for a few months because I couldn't even do my shoelaces. Yeah. I literally could not do anything, but I wanted to learn. And I was so excited because obviously being on placement is the most exciting thing when you are a medical student. And I can remember my mum had to drive me to my first day at placement. And in a way, it was quite embarrassing because I'm thinking, oh, you know, I'm a 20-something-year-old and I've still got my mum driving me back and forth. And my mum has always been the person who said, "Are you sure you can do this?" You know, she really supports what I'm doing. But in the back of her mind, she's also got her worries, naturally.
Yeah, she's a mum.
She doesn't want me to be let down. But yeah, so she dropped me off and I went into placement. And then this is when the discrimination began. So I essentially had a doctor come up to me and say, imagine you're a patient. Would you want a disabled doctor treating you? Absolutely not. And I was sent home. And as I was walking out, I didn't know what to do, because I thought if I stayed and went against this doctor's advice, I'd be seen as unprofessional. But if I left placement early because of what this doctor had said, I would also be seen as unprofessional. So I was literally, I just didn't know what to do. And anyway, so I was walking out of the ward, and another doctor came up to me and said, hang on, what are you doing with the patient's cane? So they had already assumed that because I had a white cane with me, that I was a patient. And I just said, look, I'm really sorry, but the cane's actually my cane because I'm registered blind. And he looked at me in this like look of horror, which he probably think that I couldn't see, but I could tell.
Yeah.
And he just said, I don't want you touching any of the patients. And so at that point, I just said, right, no, I'm going to go home. And I was on sort of a phase return anyway because of my recent ordeal in Italy. And my mum came to pick me up. And I can remember being in the car. And for the first time ever, I was the one to say to mum, I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't think medicine's for me. Just based on what these doctors had said to me on my first day. But here I am 2 years later. I'm still doing it. I haven't lost my...
How did you get out of that? Because obviously your mum's being cautious. You've now like flipped into that. And I'm assuming you probably shook yourself up in your Alexandra fashion, and that appears to permeate whatever situation you're in, whether you're lost in the middle of a jungle, whether you're undergoing delirium, but that must have been a very, very low point.
It was, yeah. And I think that was probably the first, because I somehow have this knack of being able to climb out of these holes. I mean, I always do in the end.
Metaphorically,
but having
physically.
I don't think I've fallen down any holes. Yeah. Just had to think about
I
that
won't
one.
Put it past you.
Just sort of like finding a solution to anything that I am thrown into. But honestly, I came home from that day and thinking, okay, so how am I going to deal with this? Because at the end of the day, I'm going to be on this placement in this block for another 8 weeks. Like, what am I going to do? Am I going to have to just put up with people just being really ignorant? Or am I going to have to put my foot down and say, look, this needs to stop? And I did. I went to the medical school and I said, look, this has happened. But instead of supporting me, they just said to me, it's not discrimination. It's the way you're perceiving things. It's your behaviour. And I think that made me more angry.
Oh, my God. That makes me bloody angry. What the hell?
What do you want? What else do you want me to say? So in the end, I just kind of had to just keep my head down. And you've almost got to play the game, I think.
It's pure victim blaming that. It's just pure, like, everything is on you, the person. Mm. It's not the system. It's not someone's negative comments. It's you. It's you're the issue. Mm. That, I mean...
And when you feel like that, you're walking around every day and you feel like you're the problem.
Absolutely.
It's a horrible thing to hang over you. But I like to try to turn everything into a positive. And that's when Faces of the NHS was born. So you may have heard of it, and I'd really like to get you involved.
I love
as well,
this beautiful segue. If you were there. I really wanted to get into it.
So it's a campaign that I started in, so I officially began it in January 2019. Mm. It's a portraiture photography campaign where I'm going around the UK and taking photos of anyone who works for the NHS, past, present, future. And they obviously share their story, a little snippet behind what they're doing, why they're doing it. And it's with the hope that it can break down stereotypes of what it means to look like a doctor, look like a nurse, look like a porter, and instead celebrate diversity. And I'm hoping that as this montage gets bigger and bigger and bigger, we can start to change. We can make a cultural shift. And just make the workplace more inclusive, not just in the NHS, but in general. And I think by using it as a photography project, it can be, it's visual, it's very easily accessible for anybody. And for those who can't see, then you have the stories of those people who were, part of the campaign. And it's really quite overwhelming because I mean, I've already taken photos of 500
people. 500
people? 500 people, yeah.
And wow.
People including, you know, Adam Kay and wow. So many, Dr. Amir Khan from Chief yeah. Behind Closed yeah, Doors. Yeah. So I've got amazing, like, so many guys on board. And I genuinely didn't think that it was going to be that, like, sort of successful. And obviously then I started talking about that in my TED Talk back in October. So it's really lifted off the ground. It's fantastic, but it's like, wow, I just didn't expect it. So I use that now as my motivation to think, hang on a minute, you know, you should be proud to be different. Mm. And actually the people who give you negative comments, they're not being horrible, mm. I don't think, most of the time. They just don't understand. And it's about educating. It's about educating everyone.
Absolutely. I think innately humans are, they are positive. They are moral. We do have an ethical backbone. But unfortunately, through the environment and the stigmatization of our roles, you know, we act in awful, awful ways. Mm. And I'm so embarrassed to hear about your experiences within the profession that is meant to be the most caring, the most empathic, but hopefully you sharing your story and your project as well will, you know, allow us to question ourselves. I mean, I'm questioning myself even this, like, would I have thought the same way had I not met you, had I not understood your story? Would I make the same judgments? And if I'm being really authentic and honest with myself, I may have. Mm. I probably wouldn't have said those disgusting things, and I certainly wouldn't have said that, but maybe to myself, would I have thought, how is this person going to be a medic? But you are proving that small little voice in my head wrong. And everything you do, you're just such a rock star, Alexandra. Oh, honestly, and you're a genuine rock star, and like, I can't wait to watch your show. You know, you said after you were on Lorraine and Jeremy Vine and Sunday Times and a whole bunch of others, you were like just getting called whilst you're on placement.
I'm in the middle of the ward randomly. Like, please be quiet. I'm trying to talk to patients.
But I just see your trajectory being huge within clinical medicine and outside of clinical medicine on a grander scale. Mm. And honestly, if you choose, and it will be your choice to leave medicine if you're ever going to do that, you could be a comedian, an author, a photographer. There's so many things you could do, honestly.
I like that. I like that kind of, like, you know, wealth of choice. But I will always, always do medicine. I mean, the thing that motivated me to do it in the first place was my experiences as a patient, but more so because I just love people. I am fascinated by people, and I just love that emotional connection between human beings. Where that will take me, I really don't know, but it's exciting nonetheless. I'll probably be gallivanting around the world in between as well. So yeah.
Great. I've got one more last thing to give you. It's your birthday today.
Oh.
So I've got you two little things. It's a banana bread.
And, oh my goodness.
And a brownie as well.
Oh, so, Ruby, thank you so much.
I know it'll probably take you like 3 hours to eat this, so you can back your document, you share it with your mum later. But I just wanted to thank you personally whilst on the podcast here, because I usually do an outro and everything, but for sharing your story, for being the person you are, and being just like I said, an absolute rock star. You really inspire me. You like, I'm just thinking of all the different things and the number of times I beat myself up, and, you know, you just have that little voice in your head that says you can't do things. You are proving everything wrong about that, and just admire you for your work, and I just can't wait to watch and support your journey going forward.
Thank you so much. And like I said to Tim, you know, you can be anything you want to be. You can do anything you want to do. Do not let anybody say otherwise. And actually, I've learned along the way, don't always take no for an answer. Because if I took that from day one, I would not be where I am today.
Wow, just wow. I'm not even going to try and attempt to sum up our conversation here. It just went through so many different emotions, and all I want you to do really is follow my guest on social media. You can find her on Instagram at Alexandra Elaine Adams, and at Faces of the NHS. All the links are going to be on thedoctorskitchen.com. Please check out her TED Talk. Again, the links for that are going to be on the website. Give this a 5-star review if it helped you or if it inspired you in any way. I read all the comments. I really, really do appreciate the love, the support, and the sharing. And send it to someone who needs a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of hope, a little bit of a feel-good moment. I think this podcast is morphing into not only discussions about nutrition and lifestyle changes and the science behind it, but also, you know, reminders to ourselves about being grateful for everything that we have in our lives. And that's all I'm going to say. Have a fantastic day. I hope you found this as inspiring as I did, as it was to meet Alexandra. And I hope that won't be the last time at all. Share it. And I will catch you on the podcast next time. Have a great day.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.